Good morning.
So this morning I'm going to talk about authenticity. Hi, come on in.
Thanks.
Authenticity. So, we, as kids, were, of course, shaped by our culture, our parents, our family. Sun practice is about moving beyond those confines. Sun practice, in Japanese, and we say jiriki, self-power, about moving beyond the constriction of the culturally formed and culturally sustained self. So jiriki, self-power in Zen, is an antidote to cowardice and contrived existence. Usually we're trained to fit in and follow orders and fit in and follow orders, or then maybe we rebel against fitting in and following orders, which is an extension of the same pattern. It's just done in a reverse way. Well, jiriki is deeper than that. It's deeper than that. Jiriki is not power over something. Authenticity, when we're authentic, we're not trying to keep others down or get higher than them. It's power to impact, to affect change, to contribute rather than stand by. And of course, it includes a quiet mind, but out of that quiet mind, we can discover a force that acts to connect to the life, to connect to world, to help folks with suffering. But in most of the time, in most of our lives, we're constantly balancing our behavior to better fit in, to feel more successful, to find love, or doing the opposite, which is, as I said, the extension of the same pattern. We want to present a pleasing image. We want to present a pleasing image to each other. And if we can't present a pleasing image, we want to present an obstreperous image. That is an image that will at least impact people, even if they don't like us. But jiriki is deeper and broader than that. Deeper and broader. So rather than showing a particular side, how do we take off the mask of our cultural conditioning and its countercultural conditioning? I grew up in a cultural conditioning, and then I was part of the counterculture, which really was in its way a mirror image of the dominant culture. Neither are bad. This is the way we take care of ourselves when we're scared, when we don't feel like we have a place in the world. They're not bad. Culture and counterculture supports us. But it's a little bit surfacey, don't you think? It's a little surfacey. And it involves so much chatter, internal chatter. Jiriki doesn't involve much internal chatter at all. And of course, the media tells us who to be, what to want, how we should be, how we should express ourselves. We get into Zen practice and we get some idea of how we should be, how we should express ourselves. But if we get caught by that stuff, it chips away at our innate ability to be authentic, to be alive just now, just this. By being someone we're not, by telling ourselves that who we really are isn't okay, we hide, we suppress. That's not bad, but we feel lonely We feel cut off. We feel disconnected from others. We feel like maybe we won't amount to not much, or we're worthless unless we go, 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 go. Unless we do this, unless we project this image, project this image, project this image, whatever it is. And we've been molded to fit in to our culture. And we develop beliefs, which are usually a product of that mold, or as I say, they're a reaction against that mold. Thoughts, emotions, behaviors that keep us just caught by some way that we should be to be okay. So how do we access our jiriki, our self-power? And those of you who heard me talk before know that I'm very fond of Walt Whitman's quote, "I am large, I contain multitudes," which Whitman got from practicing and studying Hinduism and Buddhism, in case those of you don't know about it. That's where he got it. "I am large, I contain multitudes." Your big self that contains multitudes. All the stuff that's buried in our unconscious and that which we're not conscious of, can we let it come up, open up to it? If we do, we can begin to create ourselves and allow ourselves just to be who we are, instead of being totally shaped by cultural forces or countercultural forces or family forces or any specific ideas about who we should be. So, manifesting an authentic self, whatever that is, and we don't need to know what it is risky. Risky. Suzuki Roshi called this, my teacher called this, following your inmost request. Following your inmost request. But how do we find what we really care about? And how do we manifest it? What's authentic to us? What's authentic to me is not necessarily authentic to John. What's authentic to me? To find it and develop it, I need to ride the waves of the chaos in my mind, the chaos in my culture, the chaos in my family. I need to ride those waves. Not be scared of them. Just be with them. Just be with them. So that I'm not caught by them. I need to have the courage to expose my heart to the world. Eroding the hard edges of the small, isolated self, the judgmental self, and opening up to jiriki, to jiriki. To embrace our Buddha nature, whatever that is, our instincts, but not Freudian, beyond Freudian. Well, you can include Freudian if you want, that's fine, but that's not what I'm talking about. To embrace our instincts. Be willing to go against the stream, not for the sake of going against the stream, but so that we can manifest who we really are, in spite of what's expected, in spite of what's demanded. So I've been working with a couple of people on a story from the Gateless Barrier. And this is the Gute story. So this is from 10th century China. Gute was a well-known Zen master who was laconic to an extreme. And people would come to visit him and ask him about Zen and the depth of Zen and the truth of Zen, and he would raise a finger. And so he was known for his one-fingered Zen. His one-fingered Zen. And we don't know what finger he raised. He would raise a finger. And his attendant, his priest in training, was doing his best to hang with Gute and feel Gute's vibes and become a teacher himself by hanging with him and following along. So one time, Gute was not home. I don't know where he was. And some guests came to visit the monastery. But the attendant, the priest in training, was there. And they asked the priest in training to tell him about Zen. And the priest in training went like this. And Gute was hiding in the broom closet. And he leapt out and he sliced off the attendant's finger. Ooh! He sliced off the attendant's finger. The attendant ran down the hallway yelling and screaming, and he turned around and looked at Gute, and Gute went like this. And the priest in training was enlightened on that moment. One of these ridiculous Zen stories. Enlightened on that moment. So, we can look at this story and we can see two parts to it. Actually, you can see lots of parts to it, but I'm only going to tell two parts of it. In the first place, the attendant, the priest in training, was just faking it. He had an image of how he should be, and he was, here there's these, do what his teacher said, and he got punished for that, right? That's part one of the story. Part two is that actually because of doing that and losing his finger, he attained enlightenment. Because of taking that risk, he attained enlightenment. He moved beyond his comfort zone. He took the chance he would fail. And he opened up to Jiriki. So when we take risks to express something that's kind of nebulous inside but that we really care about, we might get our finger cut off. We might. We do. Often we do. But is that a chance to open up a little bit to ourselves that contain multitudes? Develop a new self? Get into contact with a new self? I think so. Maybe so. To move beyond our limitations. To move beyond our protecting identity. So about 20 years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Antigua, Guatemala, and do a week of Spanish immersion with my wife. And this was an opportunity for me because I'd started studying Spanish when I was in about the eighth grade and been very interested in Hispanic culture, especially in California and the immigrant population. And I'd never really been very successful at it. I'm not good at spoken language. But anyway, here was an opportunity, so I went down with my wife, and we lived with a Guatemalan family for a week, and they didn't speak a word of English, and I had a Spanish tutor. He must not have been more than 18, he didn't speak a word of English, and it was 6 hours a day of one-to-one, 6 hours a day, when I sat and faced this young man, and we spoke Spanish together. Very difficult for me. Very awkward. He kept saying the same things over and over again, and I couldn't get them, and I'd say them back to him, and he'd say them again, and I started perspiring. And by the end of the first 3 hours, 3 hours is a long time to do that with no English. I was just wet. Luckily, we got a lunch break. Then I had to come back and do another 3 hours. Then at the end of those 6 hours, I was just wiped out. And then we went home to the family who didn't speak any English. And I said, well, Linda, speak English with me. And she said, no, we're supposed to speak doing Espanol. And, of course, she was good. She and her tutor were off blah, 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 doing blah, blah, blah for 6 hours. Blah, 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 all the local gossip. There I was. So then we came home, and I said to Linda, geez, I don't want to ever do that again. That was a bad idea. She said, well, you know, it was your bad idea. Okay. Well, then, a couple years later, I was directing a nonprofit and I needed to fundraise for my nonprofit. So I decided to join the Downtown Rotary Club in Minneapolis. Meet people, get to know people. And so I was, we'd go to Rotary meetings. One time a woman came to speak with us who had, was working in Guatemala. And she was an American woman and she was working on the border between Guatemala and Mexico. Guatemalan refugees had fled the genocidal warfare in Guatemala into Mexico and now things had settled down and they were trying to come back to Mexico. So they were all lined up in the border in Mexico and they were homeless and they didn't have any medicinal supplies. They didn't have anything. So we were moved by this Rotary Club woman talk. So a group of us decided we'd go down. And we got a doctor and we got a nurse and, you know, we went down. I didn't have any particular skill, but I'd been to Antigua before and we took a long drive from Antigua to the border of Mexico. But guess what? None of these Rotarians spoke a word of Spanish. And they decided moi was their interpreter. I was their guy. Even if I could only say, hablo un poco de español, un poco for them was a tremendous amount. So for a whole week, I was their interpreter. So there you go. There you go. There you go. And it's something, I had gotten more in me that couple years down there than I realized, much more in me, and I was able to just barely get along, but get along in the way these guys couldn't get along at all. So, developing authenticity. I was more alive after that. Of course, now I've let my Spanish go. Well, maybe something else will come up. Maybe something else will come up. So how do we develop our authenticity? How do we move beyond our small, confined self? Well, I'd like to just make a few suggestions of things we can do. One is, take up on something that interests you or generates a spark, even if it seems awkward or unnatural. Second is, in your bare awareness, watch for your patterns of behavior, your beliefs, your reactions under pressure, and how they confine you. And notice which of these responses don't work and which feel authentic, which feel come from some, from your jiriki, from your Buddha nature, and which you're doing just to get along or just to fit in or just to stick out or something. Try to find that, what's in here that wants to come out. And pay attention to your family system. In your family system, because of your childhood, because of episodes that occurred, you developed a kind of self that's not necessarily very authentic. A way to get along. A way to get along. And most of us did that. We did that. So notice that. Notice how those patterns impede us. Don't be judgmental. Just notice them when they come up. And we can learn a lot. So about 10 years ago, I was mentoring here at Zen Center a woman whom I will call Florence. And once I was mentoring her about her meditation, and I was, and you know, she was talking about how her thoughts and images, the same ones, kept coming up all the time. And I said to her, "Well, just let go." And the next time I was having one with her, she didn't come back. And the next time she didn't come back either. And then I saw her here on a Sunday and I said, "Oh, can we talk?" And then we went upstairs to talk for a minute. And I said, "Oh, what's going on?" And she said, "Well, you know, when you said just let go, that disoriented me. My mother used to tell me when I was a kid, when I said I wanted to be creative this way, I wanted to do this thing that really I cared about, my mother would say, "Oh, just let go. Oh, just let go." So there it was. There it was. Her mother told her that. I said, "Just let go." And it came up. it came up. So that was maybe a lesson for me about being careful of my Zen truisms. A Zen truism is not necessarily what someone needs. They need to be listened to valued, endorsed as they are, so they can develop their own jiriki instead of just let go. Right? Well, sometimes just let go is fine. Yeah, it's fine. But we need to pay attention. We need to pay attention and not just get caught by some image. Even the Zen teacher, you know, some character, oh, just let go. Right. So give our little self, our little fear-based, culturally formed self, our hearing. Give it a hug. Don't diss it. Give it a hearing. Give it a hug. Pay attention to what she's saying. What her needs are. Where her fears are. Where they are in her body. Just be with that. Just be with that. With some openness. Some openness. That's where authenticity comes from. Means listening patiently to what's going on. How is my little self trying to protect me from being hurt in ways that I've been hurt in the past? Florence's little self was trying to protect her from ways she'd been hurt in the past, so she didn't want to meet with me anymore. She needed to protect herself. Right? Oh. Oh. Self-awareness and self-honesty. Self-awareness and self-honesty. And examine our doubts about whether it's even possible to change what feels so deeply ingrained. Often it seems impossible. This pattern is so deep, I keep doing this over and over again. But there's always the possibility. There's always a possibility to tap into our self-power. So, when we have that doubt, notice where it's coming from. Feel it. And then aspire again to find an act from something deeper. And practice facing your fears. With your bare awareness meditation, with a mentor. A mentor can be really helpful. Now, this mentor program we have at Zen Center is not something that's part of our tradition. But when I hung with my Japanese teacher in San Francisco, he mentored me a lot. We just didn't use that word. We just hung out together. It was a small center, and I watched him, and he watched me, and he helped me be authentic without talking to me much at all. A mentor doesn't have to talk to you much at all. Just watch. Just pay attention to your own heart. And you'll learn how to be more authentic. You'll just develop it naturally. So the little self protects itself through fighting, fleeing, and freezing. And that's instinctual. But it shrinks us. We get shrunk. As we get older, we get shrunker and shrunker. More and more dense. Shrunker and shrunker. Well, all we need to do is remind ourselves that we contain multitudes. We contain multitudes. All we need to do, and we don't need to do anything, but we have the possibility to realize that we contain multitudes. That we can courageously excavate the buried emotion in here, the buried thoughts, and radically accept them as they are. Radically accept them. And then they let go of themselves. We don't have to let go. There is a letting go. There is an opening. In radical acceptance, notice it. There is always a letting go when there's radical acceptance. This is not acceptance when you try to be accepting. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about radical, the root of radical. Radical means root acceptance. and practice loving kindness to ourselves, practicing loving kindness to ourselves, to the small self, to the needy self. You may think you've outgrown that small self. You've been practicing for so many years. You've been in therapy for so many years. You should be beyond that. But you don't, that's made up that you're ever going to get beyond that. You have this needy self until you die. You have this little needy person in here. Well, how do I know? I'm not dead yet, but I'm I didn't say you have it after you die. I said you have it before you die. You have this needy self. So give it a little TLC. Give it a little, say, instead of thinking you should be beyond it. You don't you think I should have been, I should move beyond it? You know, I've been practicing for 50 some years. Well, I could take care of little Tim. May he be safe. May he be protected. May he feel loved. He's still in there. Still in there. Imagine breathing in each breath suffused with loving energy. Imagine that. Imagine that. So someone said to me the other day in a one-to-one, well, I'm doing loving kindness meditation now at the beginning of my Zazen. May I feel safe. May we be protected. May I feel loved. Although she's doing it in her own words. She said, and I do it for the first 3 or 4 minutes. And I said, oh, that's good. And I said, and then after that, and she said, then after that, I go back to my regular Zazen. And I said, oh, that's good. And what happens? And she said, oh, everything goes to hell. And I said, well, how about doing it for the entire 20 minutes of your Zazen? She said, is that okay? Is that real Zazen? Is it real meditation? Well, what's real meditation? Real meditation is coming back and being with whatever is going on in an open-hearted way. There's no other real meditation than that. Coming back and being open to it with some gentleness. You are large. You contain multitudes, including this small, needy self. She's part of it. She's part of it. This takes time. This practice. It takes time. It takes time winnowing our beliefs and behaviors that no longer serve us, and replacing them with more authentic behaviors. It takes time. One step forward, one step back, 2 steps forward, 1.5 steps back, 3 steps forward, 4 steps back. That's okay. That's part of the deal. Part of the deal. You can't change your consciousness overnight. So, but you can, sometimes raw new awarenesses will come up, and sometimes they'll disrupt your lives, like it did for Florence. She was disrupted by this letting go of thing. So disrupted, she didn't want to see me one-to-one anymore. I was so disrupted. Well, that's okay. That new raw awareness helped her be more alive, helped her be more open, helped her be less preyed upon by her conditioning. Right? Right? Conditioning doesn't have to prey upon us. It's meant to protect us. So let's practice as much as we can, being transparent as we can. It's easy to hide behind some kind of social persona. But let's remind ourselves that we can have a capacity to take a step. And even if we fall down, our imperfections are acceptable. Therefore, we're acceptable. Right? Very simple. Your imperfections are acceptable. Therefore, you are acceptable. And if you are acceptable, others are acceptable. Compassion toward yourself results in compassion toward others. It just happens spontaneously. So, slow down. Don't let anyone push you into making a consequential decision until you're ready. This takes a while. Speak and act from your truth, even if you're not exactly sure what it is. But if it's inside and it's not just some idea you're clinging to, let it, give it voice. Ask yourself whether you're pursuing the goals you really want to do in the way, right way you do for you. Listen to your Buddha nature. And when your little reactive self covers over everything, when you lose track of who you are, just be with that and keep open to the fact that you always have deeper aspirations. You always do. And don't stick to your story. Right? Don't stick to your story. Notice a story you tell yourself about a limitation that you have. Experiment with telling yourself an entirely different story about your future that contradicts that limitation, or about who you are that contradicts that limitation. And memories may arise to support your new story. Or you may even want to create a new memory. Replacing the old one. You can do that. And finally, be playful. Be playful as you try on different selves. Rather than the drudgery of working on myself, with sitting, I have to sit an hour, and now another hour, and now 2 days, now 4 days, and maybe I'm going to make some progress, or maybe I'm just going to, Be playful. We adopt a playful attitude. We're open to possibilities. So my teacher, I've told this story many times before. My teacher was in his 60s, and he'd been in this country for 7 years. And one of his students named Betty wasn't coming to meditation anymore because Betty's depression was so bad that when she just sat in it, and it actually increased her depression. But she was still playing tennis. She was a tennis player, and that got her out of herself. Sitting facing a wall did not get her out of herself, but playing tennis did. And so one morning I met Suzuki in the hall, and he had little white short pants on and a sailor hat covering his bald head, a white sailor hat. And I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to play tennis with Betty." And I said, "I didn't think you knew how to play tennis." And what did he say? Anybody remember? Huh? What? He said, "I don't know. Betty knows." Then I followed him to the court, and he made a fool of himself, falling around, hitting, missing, hitting, missing. And then, strangely, and laughing, a lot of laughter going on in his part and on Betty's part as she watched him. Then he took up a weekly tennis appointment with her, and they played weekly in San Francisco for several months until he got too busy. Luckily, I knew him before we got this Zen monastery, and then we got really busy. And he would come back from tennis. He would always be in a good mood. And I'd ask him how it had gone. And sometimes he'd have cuts on his arms. And he said, "Oh, fun, Tim, fun. You play with me." But I didn't want to mess with him. He did lots of stuff with me. So be playful as you try on different selves. Be playful as you try on different selves. So here's a quote from him that I'm going to end on. "You must be true to your own way until you come to the point where you forget all about yourself." That's my teacher. You must be true to your own way until you come to the point where you forget all about yourself. This is... If he could do it, I can do it. If I can do it, you can do it. If you can do it, lots of other beings can do it. So that's what I want to say this morning. And I'll be glad to take any questions or comments from anyone. Questions or comments? Yeah.
I was curious about your time when you were doing the medical volunteering, and it probably sounds like a fairly high-pressure situation if you're trying to translate with limited Spanish and you've got people providing medical care. Did you have any experiences where your little self kind of showed itself while you were in a high-pressure situation, maybe south of the border?
Well, I did. It wasn't always that easy, but since no one else spoke a word of Spanish or a word of English, then I didn't have anything to compare myself to. I was just it. So I didn't get self-conscious because nobody knew. Everybody just turned to me. I was the guy. Yeah, so.
That's lovely.
And, of course, we were working with Indios, and a lot of them, Spanish was a second language to them. So that made it easier because their Spanish was not that much better than my Spanish. They spoke slowly. I always say to Spanish-speaking people, "Más despacio, por favor." But these Indios, they speak Spanish very slowly because it's their second language. Thanks. Yeah, Tanya.
Question. So your statement, forget your story, that kind of resonated with me.
Which one? Which story resonated?
No, when you say your statement.
Forget your story. Yeah.
So I was thinking about the conversations we have with each other at tea time, and just in general social contact.
Yeah.
Seems like we tend to see those as opportunities to tell our own story. So my question is, how can we engage in conversations with each other that would encourage us to think more about talking about our aspirations and our intents and kind of helping each other forget our own story?
Well, that's pretty good. Although I didn't say don't tell your own story. I said, try not to stick to your own story. So there's a big difference. Sometimes, during coffee, we tell our own stories. We tell each other stories. And that's healthy. That's part of being human, to tell stories. It's when we stick to the story and the story just creates some density and some weight in our consciousness that we need to realize, oh, we can tell ourselves other stories. It's that story too. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, in a conversation with someone, just tell your story once. and then listen to their story before you elaborate on your story. Really listen to their story. And, telling each other stories is what humans do. It's kind of wonderful. We're storytelling people. But when we get stuck to a story, we've dampened our authenticity. We're no longer alive. And you know how older people 76 and older, that's really old, how they tell the same stories over and over again, and after a while you don't even want to be with them? So people should start doing meditation at 75. Because from 75 to when they die, that's when they really need it. Because they get so attached as you get older, the older you get, to your own story. But we're storytellers. Storytelling is wonderful. This is not dissing storytelling. That's what humans do, tell each other stories. But we should tell stories that are meaningful. Oh, we can tell fanciful stories too, but, if we tell stories to impress people, that's not so good. We're getting caught by our image. But that's okay. We do that because a little self needs to impress people. So just take care of a little self. Okay, Tanya? Other people?
I wanted to say, what a great question. I really loved hearing that. Because I come from a family of high achievers, and my husband is also a high achiever. And sometimes when we are in groups together, socializing, people think that I might be a doctor as well. I might be doing this as well. And, you know, the achieving the image of, like, what have you achieved? What do you do? So tell me, you know, and how do you start a conversation to open up someone else's truth that might not be sharing all these academic achievements or professional achievements or money-making achievements? And I had two examples of something that was really, like, impactful to me. I remember once, I'm really involved in volunteering, and I also have a self-owned business, but it's not the high achieving compared to my family or my husband. And I remember once a person asked me, so what do you do? And I was sharing about my film festival volunteering, and how I helped bring in directors. And she's like, well, but beyond the volunteer, I'm sure you have much more time. What else do you do besides that? And one is, you know, raising kids, you know, managing a family. I'm sure, like, you know, other people, men don't have to think about something, you know, like that invisible work that I do at home. But then there was another instance when someone asked me, what do you do in life that makes you enjoy, or what do you enjoy spending time in life, or something like that? So it really allowed me to share what you were saying, my aspirations and the things that I enjoy in life. And I just felt like that was the most wonderful question to open a conversation with someone without having the expectations of that image that builds up in just those achievements that society sets, you know, and just that true nature of what do you expect in life, what are your aspirations. So, yeah, that was really nice.
What you do and so
what inspires you in life? What, how do you spend your time and inspires you? Something like that.
Uh-huh.
It's just wonderful.
I really like your comment too, because it makes me think about.
Can you speak a little louder?
I like your comment too, because it's like a Midwesterner will often ask where you live and where you work, because then we kind of got you. Okay, you're this way. But people from other cultures want to know how their family is, or how, you know, how, what are their interests? Do they play a musical instrument or something like that?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's just so interesting.
Uh-huh.
You know, not easily pegged, right? Yeah.
Thank you, Judy.
Yeah.
Thank you, Paula. How was that? What'd you say? Okay. Any other people? Other people? Yeah.
So I live in the Northeast, and it was where do you work all the time?
Pardon?
Introduce your name, and then where do you work? In the Northeast when I lived there, but then when I lived in Colorado, same thing. It was, what's your name, and then what are you into?
Oh.
It was really awesome. It's like, what makes up you?
Ah.
I found that very interesting. That was always the second question.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that one just felt a little deeper and a little more open ended to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It was not
Yeah. Well, so. I guess we all need to hang out in Colorado sometime. Or maybe Ecuador.
I was thinking on the way here or at home, about to leave for here, about, it may sound like I'm drifting around, but in early middle school, I remember classroom activities, you would have to pick a partner.
Yeah.
And looking back, you realize the teacher purposely made awkward time for you to engage in those activities.
Uh-huh.
You know, they knew what they were doing. And I was just thinking, when you're children, you are about who you are.
Uh-huh.
You can't ask what you do.
Yeah. Good point.
It's kind of like society and the culture, and when you become an adult, you kind of lose the person you were when you were a child, which is
stupid. Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. You know. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Good. Thank you. Thank you.
I have a question. So sure. You talked about, like, sometimes when you're trying to understand your authentic self, it might not be clear to you what that is.
That's right.
So sometimes, you know, I'll have an impulse, or I'm in a situation and I feel like reactive or something.
Yeah.
But even though it feels very strong in that moment, it's still not my, like, authentic self.
Sure.
I'm just wondering, like, you know, how do you get to that point or kind of manage that process in yourself to open up to the authentic?
Well, you have to feel your way along. There's no formula here. You feel your way along. As I said, you begin to notice in your meditation or beyond your meditation what thoughts and feelings you have really tie into something inside you that's pretty deep, and what are more superficial, and begin then to be able to let go of the superficial ones. But I'm afraid there's no formula for doing it. It just happens. It just happens. And I think you've been doing it for the last few years, but you haven't reached an end point. And is there ever an end point? I mean, I think it's this internal exploration of who we really are goes on forever. And often we'll be confused, like, oh, is this just my little self reacting, or is this something deeper? But if we give ourselves a space, there's always the space for the depth charge to come out. Because in each reactive moment, there's space between the two reactions and space underneath them. And we discover that space, and that's where our authenticity is. But I'm not talking abstractly. I'm talking about how it's going on in here. But you've been doing that. You just need to do it for another kalpa or so. That's a joke. A kalpa is like 3,000 years or something. But you do. Yeah, you just do it. You just do it. And you become more alive as a result. So when you're 76 and you, instead of getting older, maybe you get younger, but at least you don't get any older. My body's older, but why does my inside have to get older? Yeah, my inside can get younger and younger and younger all the time. I wish my body would go along with my what's happening inside. It doesn't want to cooperate, which is why I'm sitting in a chair, a comfortable chair today. Anybody else? Thank you.